What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Saturday, June 7th. We had game one of the NBA Finals between the Indiana Pacers and the Oklahoma City Thunder on Thursday night. In what was a bit of a thriller, Oklahoma City cruising for most of the game before Indiana tapped into their voodoo magic to once again have a crazy comeback and steal game one on the road against Oklahoma City, even though they were massive underdogs. So I'm going to get into all things game one, talk a little bit about game two, and go from there. But with that said, let's go ahead and get right into it. Pacers did it again. They somehow did this again. It somehow feels equally as surprising and shocking every single time they do it, but they just keep doing it, stealing these games that they have absolutely no business winning, and they did it again in game one of the finals in a series that they are massive, massive underdogs in. The Thunder were minus 700 favorites to win the series just for game one. The Thunder were, I believe, 9 or 10 point favorites to win the game as well. Pacers are already making a series out of this thing. They've been underdogs in almost every series they've played in the postseason to this point. And so they clearly are not afraid of coming into a series with most people thinking they don't have much of a chance to win. But going into the game, there was some pretty big news announced about the lineups that the Thunder would be moving Isaiah Hartenstein from the starting lineup to the bench in favor of Cason Wallace. Hartenstein had started for them pretty much all season long. All of the postseason, he had been their starting center, but they decided to go with the smaller lineup, the five out lineup, to, I guess, match Indiana's personnel and style of play. I think they just liked some of the matchups better, which was a point that I made in my finals preview, that I thought this could be more of a one big series for them rather than a two big series for them. But to start off the game, the matchups were pretty much as expected. On the Indiana side of things, Haliburton was guarding Wallace, Nembhard on SGA, Nesmith on J-Dub, Siakam on Lou Dort, and Turner on Chet. And then on the Oklahoma City side of things, SGA was on Nesmith, Wallace on Nembhard, Dort on Haliburton, J-Dub on Siakam, and Chet on Turner. And I think a big reason why they wanted to make this switch is because I think they thought J-Dub was probably the best matchup to guard Siakam, which I do wholeheartedly agree with, rather than having to put one of the bigs on him. There's not really a place to hide Chet on one of the perimeter players like a Nesmith or Nembhard, because those guys are probably a little bit too involved on the offense to get away with that. They're always cutting, always moving, involved in the actions, and that's not really what they want Chet to be doing primarily. And this way, they were able to get another good perimeter defender on Nembhard without having to ask SGA to do it. But in the beginning of this game, the Pacers definitely looked a little bit jittery. The Thunder got off to a 7-0 start. They were very sloppy on offense. Obi Toppin came in, looked completely in over his head. Miles Turner had 5 first-half turnovers. Even Haliburton, you could hear him on the mic'd up that they had on the broadcast saying that he felt like he was a little too jittery, that he was, I won't say nervous, but just not playing his normal basketball, looked a little rattled at times, was rushing things. And it felt like at times they couldn't even get the ball inside the three-point line. They were just passing it around the perimeter until they settled for a bad shot or forced something into the paint, which led to a turnover, which they were turning the ball over at a ridiculous rate. They had 19 first-half turnovers, which, if you had told someone that going into this game, you would have said the Thunder probably won this game by 30 plus, at minimum by 20 or something like that. But despite all that, they hung around, only down 12 at halftime, and then they came out of the half looking a lot more composed. They took a lot better care of the ball in the second half, only 6 turnovers. In the second half, they were knocking down more shots. And the game was kind of stuck in this 7-13 window where Oklahoma City really couldn't quite pull away and essentially end the game. But the Pacers also couldn't quite chip away enough to get this down to a 2-possession game, let alone a 1-possession game, to put themselves in position to actually win. But that did finally change in the fourth, because the Pacers did continue to chip away like they do. They just kept playing. The Thunder offense got a little stagnant. The Pacers started to work some of their magic, hit some insane shots. I mean, between the Nembhard crossover step back three over SGA, the Miles Turner pump fake sidestep banked three-pointer from the corner wing area, they just do what they do. And Oklahoma City has the ball up one with about 20 on the clock, about 10 on the shot clock. SGA puts up a shot that he honestly probably makes 8 out of 10 times, but it just didn't go. A little long off the back of the rim. Pacers get the ball. Halliburton takes his time, dribbles to his spot right inside the arc, and knocks it down to put the Pacers up one with 0.3 seconds remaining, their first and only lead of the game. And in a game that Halliburton really did not play that well across the board and wasn't super overly involved. And I even though like they've done all of this all postseason long, I was still shocked when it happened. When he made that shot, I think this is the fourth game this playoffs I've watched with Indiana in it where I audibly shrieked when they made a shot or finally took the lead or completed the comeback. That's how ridiculous they've been. And I genuinely, what they have done this postseason, I don't think we'll ever see anything like it again. To have basically four of these games in the postseason to this point, one in each series, they are literally making it where you have to beat this team 5 times to eliminate them. And nobody's been able to do it thus far because they steal games they have absolutely no business winning. And it's almost inexplicable at this point because these things feel like flukes when they happen. But they're doing it so consistently that it's hard to even say it's a fluke. This is just how they play. They are relentless on both ends of the ball. And I think the underrated part of their comebacks is their defense. But, I mean, the Thunder were up 94-78 with just under 9.5 minutes remaining, up 15 points. The Pacers end the game on a 32-16 run. They were even up 108-99 with a little under 240 remaining, up 9 points. And the Pacers end the game on a 12-2 run. So only 2 points for OKC in the final 240. They didn't score for the final 127 of the game. And I don't know if the Pacers made a deal with the devil, what kind of voodoo magic they have, but it is just remarkable what they keep doing. And I think a lot of it is they just never stop playing. They don't lose their composure. They stick with the process, which we heard Rick Carlisle talk about at halftime, saying that he liked the process they were going through. They were just making some little mistakes execution-wise, but to stick with the process. And that's what they do. That's why they continue to be in these games and pull them out. They are now plus 40.4 in terms of net rating in the clutch in these playoffs with an 8-1 record. So you get caught in a close game with Indiana, you are likely dead in the water. And that's one of the keys that I pointed out in my finals preview as well, is that if Indiana wants to have a chance, they got to keep these games close because that's when they're at their best and that's when their opponents have really struggled. And that's what we saw out of this as well. And I mentioned the defense part of this because all the talk about Indiana is typically their offense, and rightfully so, because their offense is one of the best in the leagues and just really fun to watch and a unique style. But their defense has been spectacular throughout parts of this playoff run, specifically in these clutch games when it matters most. They have a 101.4 defensive rating in the clutch time in this postseason, which is just a really, really good number. And this has been against some really good offenses. Cleveland was the number one offense in the regular season. OKC was a top 5 offense. The Knicks were a top 5 offense. Like Milwaukee had Giannis on their team. So it's like all of these really impressive offensive teams and players that they are continuing to shut down in clutch time. And it's just so impressive what they've been able to do there. And I think we are genuinely in the midst of the greatest individual clutch playoff run by a single player we've ever seen in Tyrese Halliburton. I mean, he obviously did not have a very good game overall, only 14 points, only 6 assists, 6-13 shooting. You know, Oklahoma City did a really good job of kind of taking him out of the game. But other players stepped up through the middle part of the game. And when the game was on the line, Halliburton did what he does. He's now 5-for-5 on shots with 10 seconds or less to tie or take the lead in this postseason. He's now 4-for-4 on those shots with 1 second or less. He has 3 game-winning shots, 1 game-tying shot that, by the way, was also a toe away from being a game-winning shot. So essentially 4 game winners in this playoffs is ridiculous. They have all come in a different series. So in the four series they played, they've had one in each. So he's spreading it out, just doing it against every opponent on the season now, including the regular season. He is 13 out of 15 on shots to tie or take the lead with under 2 minutes remaining, which this has been prompting a lot of historical stats in terms of like looking since this data has been tracked of who's been some of the best clutch shooters of the last 25, 30 years. And you look, there's some really bad numbers, like Kobe Bryant, known for being super clutch, hitting game-winning shots in with 24 seconds or less to tie or take the lead in the postseason. He is 4 of 18. And that's not really an outlier. Most of these top players have really bad numbers. Kevin Durant is 25% shooting in those situations. Another guy that most people will consider to be a clutch player. Halliburton is now 7 of 10 in his career on those moments in the postseason. And what we're seeing out of him is ridiculous. He is 6 of 7 in the final 2 minutes to tie or take the lead in this postseason alone. Six shots is just ridiculous to even have made that many, let alone only in 7 attempts. In the clutch in this postseason, he's a plus 34 net rating. He has 33 total clutch points, which is second in the NBA. 12 clutch field goals made, which is also second in the NBA. Brunson is ahead of him in both of those, but Halliburton is shooting 52% in those scenarios. Brunson is shooting below 40%. So Halliburton's doing it at a much more efficient rate. He's got 8 assists in those situations to only 1 turnover. And this really is the best clutch playoff run I can really remember from a single player. The closest I could even try to name is 2018 LeBron James, when he carried a very subpar Cavs team to the finals. He had multiple buzzer beater game winners in that series. I mean, he had a series. He won the conference finals with, I think it was only one other double figure scorer on average in the series. Like, he did everything for them. But I think in terms of just late game clutch situations, you'd have to even put Halliburton above him from what we've seen. And it is just ridiculous what we've seen out of this guy. But in this game overall, I thought once Indiana started to chip away and got it down to a 1 or 2 possession game, I thought they had to win this. This was became instantly a must win for them, because we see this all the time where the big underdog is in a close game in game one. They get really close to pulling it off and then they don't pull it off. And then some people's mind go to, oh, this might be a more competitive series than we thought because look how close game one was. But usually the reverse happens, where that was their opportunity to steal a game and they didn't do it, and they don't get another opportunity to steal a game like that. And so the fact that they did pull it off, they did win this game, bodes extremely well for them. I think Oklahoma City losing this game is not a big deal for them. Like, I expect them to win game two. I still probably think they're going to win the series. But Indiana, if they lost this game, they would have been dead in the water, in my opinion, because to exert all of that energy on that comeback and then to not pull it off, it's just how many opportunities are you going to get to have OKC in late game situations with their back against the wall like that? They've been so good that you have to take advantage of those opportunities, and they did. And so that's why this was a massive, massive win for them, because game one of the Eastern Conference Finals just last year against Boston, Indiana had Boston on the ropes. They came back and had the lead. They were up 3 with under 10 seconds to go. They turn it over. Boston ties it, sends it to overtime, and then they lose in overtime. And they never recovered from that. They had some other moments to potentially win some of the other games, but they were never able to get it done. And I think if they had won that game, it would have set the tone for them in the series. But they fell short, and that's the difference between last year's Pacers team and this year's Pacers team, is that they are not losing games like that. If they have that opportunity, they are taking it every single time. And that's what's been so great about this run for them. But I think the remarkable part of this game, aside from just the comeback itself, was the turnovers. I mean, that was one of the biggest talking points going into this series, was, look, Oklahoma City turns teams over better than anyone in the league. They don't turn the ball over themselves. And Indiana has been really good at taking care of the ball, and they're a really good transition team themselves. But Oklahoma City won that battle in this game for sure. And a lot of people, like I said, if you told anyone that Indiana was going to have 25 turnovers, you would have thought it was a Thunder blowout. And that number game for Oklahoma City has been really hard for other teams to overcome in this postseason so far. Forcing this game, OKC had 17 more field goal attempts than Indiana. Like, that is ridiculously hard to overcome. But the reason they were able to survive it is a couple things. One, is that Indiana was spectacular with their transition defense. They actually had been the best transition defensive team in the postseason thus far, and they showed it again tonight. And I think this was a clear focal point for Carlisle coming into the series, because he knew they were going to turn it over. And so he got them in the right spots, getting back on defense. OKC had only a 69 offensive rating in transition in this game, after having 142 offensive rating in transition in the postseason coming into this. So, I mean, that is a significant difference right there. They only had 11 points off the 25 turnovers. A lot of that is because it was a lot of dead ball turnovers, like turning it out of bounds or travels, so they weren't really able to get out in transition as much as you'd think for 25 turnovers. But they still did a really good job of getting back and not letting them take advantage of those. I mean, 11 points off turnovers, like the Pacers had 4. So that's only a 7-point difference. So despite 25 turnovers to 7 turnovers for OKC, you'd think that the discrepancy in points off turnovers would be greater than 7 points. So that allowed them to make up that margin, because OKC just did not capitalize, even though they've capitalized on that stuff all season long and in this postseason as well. But they also made up for the possession battle in other ways. Like, they made 7 more threes than Oklahoma City did. They had 3 more offensive rebounds. They significantly outshot Oklahoma City. They shot 48% from the field. OKC was just below 40% from the field. I talked about that being a regular occurrence for Indiana. They've consistently outshot other teams throughout the last 2 postseason runs. And OKC, again, doesn't have to outshoot them if they can win the possession battle, but they weren't able to take advantage of that possession battle. So Oklahoma City's poor shooting really did cost them. And another thing is that Indiana, the fact that they were only down 12 at halftime is the other reason why they were able to win this game. I mean, they easily could have been down 20 or something. It felt like they should be down 20 with how the game looked and felt in that first half. But in the second half, they really cleaned it up. They only had 6 turnovers in the second half, which is right on par with their average of about 12 or 13 a game. They made much smarter passes. They forced things less. And they shot super well, 51% from the field in the second half. They were 10 of 20 from 3 as well. And another way I thought they were able to overcome that disadvantage was their 3-point shooting. They not only shot it well from deep, but they shot more threes than they have throughout this season. They actually, for their offensive firepower that they've had all year, don't shoot that many threes. They were only 20th in the NBA in terms of frequency of shots or percentage of their shots from deep at 37%. They shot 44% of their shots from three in this game, which would have ranked 2nd overall in the NBA this year over a full season. And part of that is because they kind of really struggled getting the ball inside. The Oklahoma City defense was smothering them down low and just made it really difficult for them to get anything down there. But credit to them, because they took what Oklahoma City gave them. This is one of the things I talked about, is they allow a lot of threes, but specifically the corner threes. And the corner threes in this game, they were 10 of 16 from the corner. And OKC only took 10 threes from the corner. So they made as many as the Thunder took. So that is a way for them to win on the margins. Oklahoma City is the best team in the league at winning on the margins with their turnover and possession battle. But Indiana needs to find other ways to win on the margins, and that's what they did in this game with the offensive rebounding and the 3-point advantage that they had. And so credit to them for just taking what the defense was giving them and executing. I mean, I think everybody knows Indiana is a really good shooting team, and so that's going to be something that OKC needs to kind of potentially adjust to and say, do we want them having this big uptick in 3-point shooting for a team as good at shooting as they are, for as many threats as they have from out there? So we'll see if Oklahoma City adjusts there at all, or do they just hope that Indiana, by law of averages, will cool off a little bit from outside. I thought the Thunder also did a really good job of guarding Haliburton. Like I said, it was not his best game. He was not super involved. He only had a 19% usage rate in this game, which is well below his season average and well below what you want if you're Indiana. He was used a lot more off ball, especially down the stretch of this game. If you're Indiana, they need to find better ways to get him involved, to get him in advantageous situations, because obviously it's not just that Lu Dort was guarding him, who's a really good defender, but they were sending multiple guys at him at times and just making it really difficult for him to even get the ball, let alone do anything when he had it. But Hellebuyck's going to get most of the love in this game because of the game winner, but I thought Andrew Nembhard was the MVP for them in this game. I thought he was the reason they were even in the situation they were in, because down the stretch of this fourth quarter, Halliburton was not, he was playing off ball. Nembhard was the main ball handler. He was running the offense. He was initiating everything for them down the stretch, and he thrived doing it. He had 8 points and 3 assists and was plus 16 in the fourth quarter in roughly 9 minutes. He scored or assisted on 16 of their 32 points in that late run when from the moment he checked in the fourth quarter. But on top of that, he was also guarding the MVP, guarding Shea on the other end, picking him up full court, 94 feet. And SGA got his, obviously, but he made it. He made him work for it, at least, you know, 38 points on 30 shots. I think you're going to live with that if you're Indiana. It's a lot of shots and it's not insanely efficient. It's not like he had an inefficient game, but it's just a lot of volume for him to get to 38 points. And Nembhard, another guy who's been so good in the clutch for this team in the playoffs so far in the clutch time, he's 7 of 11 from the field, 4 of 6 from 3, 3 from 3 at the free throw line. He has 4 stocks, 3 assists, only 1 turnover. So Nembhard, to me, like, if he doesn't hit that step back 3, they don't win the game. If he doesn't play make down the stretch, find open shooters, they don't win that game. Like, he was so, so big for them. And that's what makes his team so dangerous, because, like, you think you chop off the head of the snake in Halliburton and it should be smooth sailing, but they have so many weapons. Like, Nembhard is better than the role that he's in right now. I genuinely believe if you put him on another team, he could probably average close to 20 a game, 6-7 assists on efficient shooting. Like, I think that highly of him, and that's how good he's been in these playoffs. We saw it last year when Halliburton got hurt in the conference finals. Nembhard kind of took over for them in some of those games. We were getting Jalen Brunson comps when he was in Dallas and Luka was hurt. Like, I don't think he'll ever be as good as Jalen Brunson is. But the point is, like, I think there's a lot of untapped potential there in Nembhard. And for him to do this on this stage, on both ends of the court, it is just, he deserves so much credit, regardless of what happens in this series, as just a high impact guy, two-way player. And again, a guy that's just underrated with what he can do on both ends. I think another reason why the Pacers were able to win this game is because the Pacers forced OKC into a ton of isolation ball. That's just not really how they want to play. They averaged 27 assists as a team per game on the season. They had only 13 in this game, which was a season low not only for the playoffs, but for the entire year. That was the lowest assist count they had all season long. 13 assists on 39 made field goals compared to Indiana's 24 on 39. And SGA had only 3 assists compared to 30 field goal attempts. That's not a ratio that's going to be an advantageous one for OKC. 1 assist for every 10 shots he takes. And they are 0-2 in the playoffs now when they have less than 20 assists. And it really felt like down the stretch, their entire offense was just, Shea, can you please bail us out? Especially late in that fourth quarter. And I thought Shea's shot selection was a little, you know, iffy at best in this game. It felt like he was forcing things. It kind of felt like he went into this game saying, I'm going to shoot 30 times. Like, he was just pulling up, like, kind of early in the shot clock on some of these possessions, like pulling up from 3 instead of trying to get more to his spot in the mid-range or at the basket. And of course, he had a great game. No doubt about that. 38 points. He was great. And really the only reason that they didn't get, like, blown out to an extent. But I still feel like he really had to work. And he took, like, shots that I don't feel like are the type of shots that has made this team really good all year. I mean, he had a 37% usage rate, which is a lot higher than he had been throughout the whole postseason. He was 32.6% during the rest of the playoffs, which doesn't sound like a huge bump up, but that couple percentages does make a difference in some of these series. It's really hard to win any series when you have your main guy at 38-37%. And we've seen that be the case for teams in the past with more heliocentric offensive players. But from the 5:57 mark on of the fourth quarter, non-SGA players scored only 2 points and had 0 made baskets, basically the final 6 minutes of the game. And SGA scored 10 points in that span, but none of his points were assisted. So again, just so much isolation asking him to bail them out. He took 6 of their final 9 shots, but huge credit to the Pacers defense because it felt like this was intentional on their end. They held OKC to a 107.8 offensive rating in this game. And we've seen this strategy against OKC be successful in the past. It felt like Dallas did a little bit of this last year when they beat them, where they were like, SGA, go ahead, get yours, do your thing, not sending doubles, score, get to your spots, have 40 if you want, but we're not going to let the other guys beat us. And it took some of the other guys out of their rhythm, genuinely, because Chet and J-Dub were just terrible in this game. Jalen Williams was 6 for 19, 17 points. Chet had only 6 points on 2 of 9 shooting. He only played 23 minutes, which is kind of crazy. Only 4 minutes in the fourth quarter. They went to a complete small ball lineup down the stretch. But because SGA was just kind of saying, I got this, guys, the other guys couldn't get in rhythm. And then when it mattered, they weren't able to make the shots they did have. And they were just asking SGA to do everything. So that sort of isolation heavy offense, I don't think is going to be the formula for OKC in this. But again, credit to Indiana for forcing them into that kind of play. And also for the transition defense, which allowed them to force OKC to play more half court offense, which is what led to more of this isolation play as well. The other big thing to discuss here, which I already kind of touched on, was the lineup switch. I thought that going away from Hartenstein did work early. I mean, I know Wallace had the biggest negative plus minus on the team, but look at how many turnovers they forced. Like, I don't think that they're doing that if Hartenstein is playing his normal load of minutes, because they were much more versatile defensively. They were able to switch more, and that's really what caused Indiana to be so out of sorts offensively, in my opinion. So I don't think it's fair to say that the lineup switch didn't work, but I do think it's fair to criticize some of the rotation decisions from Dagnall in this, because I was advocating for the one big lineups, but one, it felt a little weird for them to not at least just roll with what had worked and then adjust if needed, rather than just going straight into it. Like, they were 80-18 on the season coming into this year. It is very weird for them to adjust before the series even starts, adjust to a team that nobody even thought would be here, huge underdogs, to say, okay, we're going to concede to the way you want to play before the series even starts. That felt a little weird to me, and I thought maybe they should have seen what the two big lineup looked like and then switched from there rather than just going right into it. But also, two, I probably would have went with Caruso over Wallace. He's just been better for them in the postseason. Wallace has been good, but Caruso's been such a high-energy guy. He's a little bit more reliable of a ball handler. He's been a better shooter in this postseason, and he's, at this point, still a better defender. And a guy that you can switch onto Siakam a little bit more seamlessly, where we saw part of the reason Wallace wasn't great in this is because they were getting switches of Wallace on Siakam, and Siakam was just bullying him down low. You get Caruso in that situation, and it's a lot harder for Siakam to eat, as we saw when Caruso was guarding bigger guys like Jokic and Randle in some of the previous series. But when I said it shouldn't be a too big series for them, I didn't necessarily mean they should completely abandon it, because they didn't. Hartenstein and Chet didn't share the court for 1 second of this game. I didn't think they were going to just throw it out the window completely. I think there is still a time and place for that lineup. If Thomas Bryant is in the game, I see no reason why they can't roll that lineup out. During the Miles Turner and Obi Toppin minutes, I think certainly you can still do the two big lineup and have Chet kind of cheat off of Toppin. I think Siakam is really like the matchup that makes it most difficult to do the two bigs. But whenever he's out, I see no reason why they can't roll that out there. And they won the just Chet minutes. They won the just Hartenstein minutes, but they got destroyed, a minus 31 net rating in the minutes with neither of them out there. So the other weirdest part is that Dagnall completely abandoned both the bigs. I mean, Chet played only 23 minutes. That's just not enough. He is their clear-cut third-best player, sometimes their second-best player, and legitimately like a top 40 guy in the NBA. I just don't understand why you would completely abandon him. I know he wasn't playing great offensively, but you got to rely on what's got you here. It's game one. You don't have to make crazy adjustments in game one. You got to see how it plays out and then adjust. And to be 80-18 coming into this game on the season and to only play your top 40 guy, your clear-cut third-best player, only 23 minutes when he didn't have foul trouble or anything, just felt like a weird decision by Dagnall. So I personally, I would probably either put Caruso in the lineup in place of Wallace, and I would also play a little bit more of the two bigs, and I would definitely play Chet more minutes if I was Dagnall going into the next game. But for game two, adjustments for OKC, I think the obvious ones, one, are that Chet and J-Dub, they just have to play better. They can't have those guys scoring 23 combined points on 8 of 28 shooting. And then Chet has to play more. Abandoning the two big lineups, I don't think that that was necessarily the right move altogether. So Dagnall has to manage how those guys stagger and what their minutes look like better, especially with Chet. He cannot play 23 minutes. They are not going to win at the same rate they have all year with him playing that little. Next, I think SGA has to be a little less shot happy and look to get others involved. I think they need more offensive ball movement, more player movement, less isolation. I already mentioned they had the lowest assist total they had all year. You're not going to win a lot of games when that happens. Then I think they have to score way better in transition. I mean, they have to go for the kill shot. They only had 11 points off the 25 turnovers. They had a 69 offensive transition rating in this game. Like, that number has to be higher. They need to take advantage of when they turn them over, because otherwise, if you're not scoring off those turnovers, then they mean nothing. You're just trading empty possessions back and forth. And Indiana is going to score at a more efficient rate in the half court, most likely more consistently, because they just are a better shooting team than the Thunder across the board, both from three and just overall. Then I think they need to also find a way to get Chet in better spots defensively. I think the reason that Dagnall benched him is because he didn't think he was having the defensive impact that we know he can. And a lot of that is just because the nature of the matchups. He's at his best when he can be sort of a roamer in space near the basket on defensively as a rim protector, but the nature of his matchups haven't allowed him to be there. So I think they got to switch some looks up to see if they can get him there. A zone against Indiana could be a bad idea, but at the same time, if you can get him in the paint more consistently, I think that's better for Oklahoma City. I think maybe they can try him on Siakam a little bit more. I know they didn't really go to that matchup, but at least Siakam lives a little bit more in the paint area, so Chet would be kind of there. And then he's also a guy that you kind of maybe can cheat off of on the three-point line. I know he shot it really well in the playoffs thus far, but that's not necessarily his calling card. But going into the next game, I honestly do expect it to be probably an Oklahoma City win via a blowout. We've seen them against Denver when they blew that game one. They ran them out of the gym in the next game by 30, 40 points or whatever it was. But I got to be careful saying that, because the Pacers, I think the normal intuition on those types of games is that the other team, they got their one, they're happy with it. They might get complacent in game two, but the Pacers have not done that. They are the ones who have gone for the kill shot and say, well, what if we win both of these games on the road? And they get greedy, and that's why they've gotten here. And so my intuition says Oklahoma City by a lot in the next game, because they're probably going to be pissed and make some adjustments. But Indiana also didn't play their best game. Haliburton wasn't very good. Siakam didn't have his absolute best game. They turned the ball over like crazy. Like, there's a lot of things that Indiana can clean up. And if they do some of that, then I think they still will have a shot to keep game two close. And doubting them has been not a smart thing to do in this postseason, but I do think Oklahoma City probably wins big, just because they are going to feel like it's a must win. And in a lot of ways, it might be. And last question here is, do the Pacers really have a chance to win this thing now? And I still think Oklahoma City will win the series. I picked them in five. I think probably I'd go six now. I think they'll win one of their home games at the very least, and it will be 2-2 going back to OKC. I do still trust this Thunder team to get it done and take care of business. But hey, if you're the Pacers and it's 2-2 going back to OKC, you've got a game six at home. If you can win that and get to a game seven, anything's possible in a game seven, especially with this Pacers team. You expect a game seven of the finals to be a little bit more tense and maybe low scoring. And those are the kind of games that Indiana has won in this playoffs. And so I can't say that they have no chance to win it, because saying they have no chance to do anything has just proven to be wrong and kind of stupid in this postseason. But like I said, I still think Oklahoma City will win. I'm not going to overreact to one game, but this certainly makes things more interesting. And they, again, are a team that you have to take seriously. And OKC needs to execute better. They need to make some of these adjustments if they want to make this as short of a series as people thought it would be, but we will see how it goes. And you certainly can't rule out either team at this point. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Thank you so much for listening. Game 2 is tomorrow, Sunday night. So I will have another pod talking about that game afterwards once that one concludes. It's very exciting that we're at the very least going to have a 1-1 series going back to Indiana, which will make it interesting. You know, I really just wanted this to be a competitive finals, which I was worried it wouldn't be, but Game 1 was about as competitive as it gets, so we will see. I don't know if Indiana knows how to not be competitive in games. So really awesome Game 1. Looking forward to Game 2. So with that said, thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you soon.